Excision number 23213, Reel 2.
Major Potts, Reel 2. You were saying you were told you were going to join the Ferret Force.
Yes. We went down to Port Dickson. I think it was Port Dickson. Where we did some training. I'm really very hazy about this.
Do you remember anything about training?
Well, it was merely gelling together Sikhs, Gurkhas, police. There were some other army people. I think the patrol was commanded by a couple of planters who had been with 136 group. I can't honestly remember very much about it. I remember it was fairly intensive, and I don't think I stayed there more than about a month. And operational. Yeah, and I think we might have been 2 months. I don't think it was. I think it was a month. And our ferret was disbanded as being. I think it just didn't work.
Do you know why that was?
I think we were too much of a hotchpotch. You know, there were too many people from different organisations, from ethnic. It just didn't work.
Did you do any operations before it was broken up?
I think we did two, and we had no contact. And then I went back to Labis again from there.
What happened there?
Well, I went back to the platoon I was in. we continued. It was at Labis that we actually... We did have two contacts at Labis. First contact was we searched a labour lines, and we got some information from the locals that there was a terrorist organisation fairly near, and we went out. And we tried to, I've got it written down, but I can't. we went out and we tried to get a machine gun into position. And it was elephant grass and everything, never got into position. So we never stopped the enemy from getting away. And then we went on. And then I remember the next bit fairly explicitly. We went on for about 2 miles along a track at the edge of the jungle, near the edge of the jungle. And we had a Sakai being a native indigenous person. And we came to an open area. And as we got into the open area, the Sakai jumped. And I was number three, and we captured a woman who shouldn't have been there, because there shouldn't have been anybody near the edge of the jungle. And anyway, we caught her, and I think there were only six or eight of us. I think it might have been six. It might have been eight. Anyway, it was then getting on in the afternoon, 5, 6 o'clock. So we went back to a native hut, which was unoccupied on a hillock. And the platoon commander said, right, I want the Sakai to go back with soldiers. The railway line is up there about 800 yards. Turn right and go to the police station at Bedok. So I said, well, what are we going to do? And he said, well, we're going to stay here because this woman was coming from the jungle. There may be other bandits in the jungle. And I said, I think this is a very bad appreciation, sir. Was only three of us you've kept behind. Myself, I remember plainly as today, I was scared witless. There was this platoon commander, Baldock, who was the other rifleman, been in Burma with the Debs, and myself. And he said, no, we're perfectly all right on this hillock. We can't be rushed and everything. Well, just before last light, and in Malaya, last light comes down very quickly, two or three people appeared about 800 yards away carrying weapons. And we watched them, and we were soaked. It had been raining. And they went back into the jungle. And so we were alert, fairly alert. And anyway, the next morning, when it was first light, we sat there and shivered and had no food. And first light next morning, I said to the platoon commander, I think we ought to go back and report what we've seen. No, we're going on, he said.
Did you have any wireless set? Or
no wireless set. Anyway, they never worked, those stupid little sets. So we went on to where we'd seen these two men enter the jungle, or at the entrance to the jungle, and there was a path. So we went up the path about 300 yards, and we came to a Y junction. And I and the platoon commander went up one, and Baldock got down behind a log, and he said, well, you stay there, Baldock, and keep a guard if anybody comes down, and we'll go up here. Well, we'd gone up about 30 or 40 yards when there was a clatter of fire, and I rushed back, and there was Baldock swearing his head off, and so one Chinese came down with an automatic, and I shot at him and missed him, and he went off up the track, up the other track, and so I said to him, Hughes, well, that was the name of the platoon commander, I said, this is, we're now in stumpf position. If there's anybody else up there, they'll have heard us, and either they're going to come down or what have you. So he said, no, we'll go up the track and try and get them. By this time, I was feeling pretty scared. I'm not a brave bloke. Anyway, went up the track about 500 yards, and we came into a blooming great bandit camp for 250 bandits. And in the middle of it was a great big cooking pot still cooking rice. And this idiot said, I think we'll ambush this. And I said, no, we're not ambushing anything. I'm going back. And Baldock's coming with me, and you can ambush it on your own. I'm not going to... Don't. There was a row. And Baldock said, I think the corporal's right. We go back and report it. We took a whole lot of communist paraphernalia back with us. Flags, Red Star hats. And we reckon it about 200, 250.
What sort of
at-at bashes,
all round.
Mm-hmm. And it was flattened in the centre. It was a parade ground there.
But there was nobody there.
There was no one there. So, anyway, were they gone? We found this out at a later date when the first shot was fired. They'd gone. And behind the camp, about 1,000 yards, there was a road that ran across. And a later follow-up patrol found where they'd gone across. Anyway, I had to go back and we'll patrol from the company with a company commander. And never saw the platoon commander again, ever. He disappeared, thank goodness. And that was the end of that engagement. It was a draw. That was the first contact. No gold draw. But I must say, he was a arrogant, as I said before, young man.
It sounds as though the Chinese were, that time, the communists in large numbers, and they must have been very competent to have had a large camp close to a road.
Well, yes. I came across one other large camp, which I'll tell you about later on.
What was the general level of activity at that time, then, when you did this first successful?
I think, basically, we were trying to make contact with the enemy, but we didn't know who the enemy were and where they were. And they'd been at it since the 39-45 war. A lot of these guys were ex-136 and communist carders that had holed up in the jungle and gone back in 6 months before the emergency was declared.
And what was their level of activity? What sort of things were they doing in the area?
They were doing terrorizing local tappers for food and recruiting young men and indoctrinating them in communism. So I learnt later.
You weren't aware of that at the time?
I was aware, but only had worked it out in my own head. Nobody had told me that.
Did you have any connection with the police?
We did, but the police at that time was very under strength. And of course, the majority of them were Malays and were not Chinese. And as a result, our intelligence information was basically nil.
What about the planters that you were dealing with? What sort of state of mind were they in at this point?
Planters seemed to me to have, they put lights.
You were saying about the planters.
Planters. They seem to have protected their buildings, not their labour lines, but their buildings at that stage, and they had electricity, and they had recruited local Malays who had been issued with rifles as guards. So they were semi-okay.
Were they disposed to make a fight, as far as you could tell?
Well, I think so, yes. But the communists were not prepared, as far as I know, to make a big issue of it because they were still trying to build up their cadre of recruits.
What about the labourers? Were they primarily...
They were primarily Tamil, and we didn't have anything to do with them, really. I don't think the Chinese and they made contact as such. If they did, it was to put out food or leave it somewhere.
They mentioned Sakai. What did you think of them? Were they useful trackers and guides?
Well, I think... difficult to judge. I came across the same thing in Kenya. Being a tracker myself now, having done a long tracking course, I would say they would say what they wanted or thought that you wanted to hear. Very much so.
Anxious to be obliging.
Oh, yes. So that was that. We continued on in Johor for another few months. We had one more contact. A chap got up and ran near Bedok village, and we shot him. He was not actually carrying a weapon. I can't remember. I don't think he was carrying a weapon, but he had a lot of money in his pocket.
How far were you from him when he was put up?
Well, he was in long, long overgrown grass, and we were coming toward, going across to look at a couple of houses. I suppose it was a patrol of 10 under a sergeant. And he got up and he was shot. I mean, there was no sort of thing of, he was trying to get away. There was no halt or I'll shoot you. And he was carrying quite a lot of money. He was carrying over $1,000, which was distributed amongst the patrol.
Was he wearing any sort of uniform?
No, he was wearing a sort of khaki, but he didn't have a Red Star hat.
Was he ever identified?
I think he was, by the police. In Bedok Village, he was identified as a known agitator and troublemaker.
Suspicious person.
Yeah, he was definitely a terrorist when you go back later and think about it.
What was the aim of your patrols at this stage? You said earlier that the little patrols were for sharing the flag.
Yeah, at this stage we were still, I suppose, until we went up to Pahang, which was 6 months, we were still wallowing, really, in what we were trying to find out who the terrorists were, where they were, and what they were doing.
So this is essentially reconnaissance patrol.
Well, that sort of thing, yeah.
Who was actually directing the patrolling program? Was this being done by a company?
Company, I think, yeah. It all seemed to happen at about 8 o'clock at night. You were told, get your kit on and get down to battalion or company headquarters.
Did you go out at night, or was it mainly daytime?
Mostly daytime. We did a couple of approach marches at night, which were a complete and utter disaster. Well, everybody got lost, or the noise got greater, and the British soldier at night is never very good.
Did you manage to get better equipment or to improve your equipment by field modifications?
Oh, we did, but a lot of it was all things like Sten guns. You know, we made our own Sten gun magazine holders. We strapped magazines together so that they were back to back. We quite like, I can't remember when they came in, but we did eventually get the small rifle with a flash indicator, you know the one I expect, which we found were better and lighter to carry in the jungle, and they didn't get caught up on all the vines and everything else. Stun gun was all right if it was cleaned. We did have some old Lanchesters at one time. Yeah, well, it was very light. It was an Australian weapon, I think. But they were heavy, very heavy. And they weren't very popular. Bren gun was the thing to have. And the Bren gun, in my opinion, should always be at the leading the patrol.
What about grenades? Do you think they were of any value?
We did have grenades. We had phosphorus and the 36. Only time I ever had grenades was up in just before the end, and we went on an ambush at night, and the sergeant who was in charge of the ambush, I was on the ambush, and we were in a cutting, took the detonators out, as he said it was dangerous to have detonators in grenades. And two people came through the ambush, and we missed them. But that was the standard of some of the senior NCOs we had at that time. Very low grade.
What about clothing? The
clothing improved. We got jungle hats. We got sweat scarves, but we never, the whole time I was in Malaya, we never got anything more than a poncho to keep you dry. If you built a basher, you had to use the leaves and the rattan, which was around, And we all got matches for cutting. And we got jungle boots, as I say. But they wore out in no time at all. A month, your jungle boots were over. You know, they're finished. Our biggest problem was most probably leeches. We used to get bitten pretty regularly by leeches. Well, the only way to try to get a leech off, as far as I could find out, was a cigarette when you stop, and you put it on the leech. But they got everywhere, and they were a bloody nuisance.
Were there any other hazards to help in the jungle?
Well, virgin jungle, of course, is not virgin at all. It's jungle that's been cut down and just allowed to grow. And as a result, very difficult to get through it. You most do, cutting your way through, you most probably go only 200 yards in an hour.
How far could you see in that kind of ground?
Oh, no distance at all.
Did that make the ears more valuable than the eyes when you were on a patrol?
Well, I often wondered. Can I digress a little bit here? I often wondered, the average British soldier, through the years, once he gets hot and sweaty, his head goes down and he looks at the ground and he plods on. And I devised, when I became an officer, that people tried to become interested, tried to make everybody interested in birds, butterflies, and animals, and you give them a tin of cigarettes if they produce something you hadn't seen before. I don't know if you've come across that before, but it is quite a good way of training soldiers to keep their heads up.
Make them alert.
Make them alert, yeah. But I didn't do that until after career. I think there were a lot of people, even in the early days, who spent 2.5 or 3 years in Malaya, and they never had a contact. You had to move. You had to make yourself, it's very difficult to explain, aware of where you were, what you were doing, which way the water was flowing in a stream. Were you the right side of the watershed? All sorts of things. There were a lot of things that you had to work out. Was the area being used for timber? Were timber lorries coming in? Therefore, timber lorries can bring food for bandits. And if so, should you ambush timber camps? I would say yes.
Well, you should put them under surveillance.
Yeah, put them under surveillance. But
how long did it take, do you think, to acquire that knowledge and those skills to make you an efficient patroller in jungle country?
I think 6 to 9 months to start with. But you go on learning all the time, and I don't think I, even though I became a tracker under world famous trackers, I don't think I was a good tracker.
Did you have any training in these skills, living in the jungle, moving in the jungle, observing the jungle?
Not when we started. Nobody thought about it. Burma had finished. Here we were, garrison duties, guard duties in Singapore, and then suddenly thrown into this emergency. And I now understand that the terrorists, they called them CTs, communist terrorists afterwards, but they were, I think we just called them bandits to start with, had been at it for getting everything ready for a good year, 18 months before the emergency started.
Did you find that some soldiers adapted to the jungle conditions and work in those circumstances better than others? What was the matter of temperament?
I think actually a chap from a rural area will work in the jungles of Malaya or all the savanna and forests of Africa much better than an urban soldier. Likewise, an urban soldier will notice in a town in things that a rural soldier won't pick up. I've always thought that.
What about your soldiers in your section? Were they balanced between rural origin and being of urban origin?
I suppose they were pretty well balanced. I don't think I ever had the same section after the first 3 months, ever. You know, people were coming, people were going, people had to go and see the dentist, and that was a 2-day journey. Or they caught VD. You know, you were a section commander, but your section was changed pretty rapidly.
Sounds rather turbulent.
Well, it was, yes. I'm not certain we were a good battalion.
When you went on your patrols later, I mean, did the style of patrolling change? Did you do long range?
No, I was never on long range patrols. A week, 10 days were the most we ever did. And the way we did it was wrong. I now know that. But it wasn't for me to say. We set up a base camp, we made noise, we washed, we shaved. We did all the things we shouldn't have done.
What is wrong with washing and shaving? It's supposed to be important for the maintenance of morale.
Well, soap can be smelt, especially by terrorists. Same. I mean, a good terrorist will know whether it's a terrorist lot who are up the in front. If they're smoking Chinese cigarettes, but if they're smoking Best Virginia, they know they're British. It's as simple as that. You've just got to go native as much as you can. And I think Kitson, this is what Kitson did with gangs and counter gangs.
Were you able to go native to any extent?
No, not in a UK battalion. It was against the ethos of the battalion that you must wear your, you know, all your right kit if you ever have to go to battalion headquarters.
You were saying you had 4 contacts altogether. What were the others? I think you described 2 contacts.
Can I do this at a later date, this one? Because it's basically... We moved then up to Pahang.
Apart from patrols then, what other things were you doing? You said you had
bus escorts. Maybe going to lorry escorts, patrols, ambushes. Just general sort of things. It's very difficult to describe.
How were the ambush sites chosen? Were they based on?
I think most of the ambush sites were chosen from maps or information received from local Chinese who wanted to curry favour with us. We never got very much from that type of information. Special branch gave us information. I can't remember ever having success on a special branch information. But there you are. That's life.
What would you do when you set up an ambush? How many men would you take normally?
Well, if you were doing a cutting on a road, anything from about 10, 14. as long as you had good fields of fire,